Preet Bharara was U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York until he was fired by President Trump. His new book, Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law, explores the justice system through his experiences. Bharara served as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District from 2009 to 2017. He oversaw the investigation and litigation of all criminal and civil cases and supervised an office of more than 200 assistant U.S. attorneys who handled cases involving terrorism, narcotics and arms trafficking, financial and healthcare fraud, cybercrime, public corruption, gang violence, organized crime, and civil rights violations. In 2017, Bharara joined the NYU School of Law faculty as a distinguished scholar in residence. He is also the host of Stay Tuned with Preet, a podcast focused on issues of justice and fairness. And again, his new book is Doing Justice. It's a pleasure to welcome Preet Bharara to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You served as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York from 2009 to 2017. You write about this deeply and beautifully in the book about the power of that district and what you were doing. Talk a little bit about, through that lens, of why you thought this was an important story to tell.
Well, I think for a lot of reasons. I all of a sudden had some time on my hands. I left office in 2017 when I was fired by the President of the United States. And it occurred to me at some point when I was in office that maybe I would write something that would be a guide to how people should exercise their discretion when you have a lot of power, and how, you know, justice is done through prosecution in that office. And then I left the job and had some time to reflect. And then I realized that some of the stories that I had to tell about the women and men in that office and how they went about doing their job of doing the right thing for the right reasons in the right way every day, even if they didn't always get it right, that the stories of how they, you know, grappled with issues of truth and justice and decision-making and fairness and open-mindedness actually were things that were usable by everyone. Whether you're in a school or you're in a company or you run an institution or you're in law enforcement, that every day people make judgments about other folks. Every day people make decisions about punishment, about discipline, whether it's your own kids or someone in the workplace. And I think that we're at a time now where sometimes these concepts of truth and evidence and reason and expertise are turned on their head. And, you know, I don't spend a lot of time talking about Donald Trump, almost no time talking about Donald Trump, even though, you know, one reviewer referred to the book, interestingly, as sort of a metaphorical survivor's guide to the Trump era. And I guess it's a little bit that, without really talking directly about Trump, because I think we spend too much time sometimes, and you have Twitter for that, by the way, dealing with the ups and downs of, you know, his tweets every day and the ways that he, you know, in my view at least, undermines concepts of rule of law, that sometimes it's a good idea to take a step back and go back to first principles and basics and try to figure out in an ideal world, what is the best way of getting to the truth? What's the best way of getting to a fair result in any kind of process? So that's why I wrote the book. And I think it also has some additional value to people because a lot of folks are paying attention to the Southern District because they've overseen and are continuing to oversee the Michael Cohen case, that if you want to have an understanding of the character of that place, the philosophy of that place, how people make decisions, how they think about it, and how heroic some of those folks are, I think it's a good read.
When you leave and there is someone new, of how much that job changes, of how much that office and its ideology changes. Many of the same people are still there. And I'm just curious as to, because we can use it as an example of what happens when the person at the top leaves and ultimately what role and what imprint they put on that office.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I think it's an important question for you to ask and for me to answer, because I think there are a lot of myths about this. You said, to what extent does the ideology change? That place has no ideology. No prosecutor's office should have an ideology, should be anywhere that you can place on the spectrum of liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. As I often said, you know, I would quote a friend of mine, you know, there are three political parties in the country. There's Democrat, Republican, and federal prosecutor. And by that, you mean that it didn't matter. And you don't care about people's party affiliation, either in the hiring of them or in the promotion of them or in how you select your targets and your subjects, who you charge, who you don't charge. And so there's great continuity. The only person who really changes when a new president comes in, and sometimes that doesn't even happen, and for a while I thought that was going to be me as well, is the political appointee, the U.S. attorney. And then, you know, that person generally brings in, you know, one or two people at the top to be his or her deputy, or chief of the criminal division or chief of the civil division. But everyone else, they're career public servants. And so when I showed up as the U.S. attorney, I inherited the 220, assistant U.S. attorneys that my predecessors had hired. And when I left, you know, Jeff Berman has hired some new people on his own with attrition. But, you know, he has a class of people who are folks that mostly I hired. And that's, I think, as it should be. So there's great continuity with respect to how people think about the job, what the values of the place are. But as I also write in the book, for an institution to thrive and be good and to meet future challenges and to change with the times, you need continuity, sure, you know, and values of integrity and good conduct and adherence to principle, but you also need change. And those changes are not in what the outlook of the place is. Those changes are things that evolve depending on what the threats are. So when I showed up in 2009, the cyber threat was starting to become something very important to the FBI, the intelligence agencies, to the Treasury Secretary and others. And over the course of my time there, we amped up the ways in which we dealt with the cyber threat. And I think a lot of people today, you know, are focused on it in a way that we weren't a decade ago. And in some other things, you know, the mafia is still alive and well and still kicking, as I would say, and they're still intimidating people and using extortion. But is it to the same degree that it was 20 years ago, 25 years ago? It's not. So the changes that happen when new leadership comes in, I think, are things that depend on what the priorities should be in the office, maybe the energy of the office, but there's no change in, and should not be any change in sort of political outlook, because there should be no political outlook.
One of the things I found fascinating in the book is that you spend a lot of time in the book writing about the cases that you didn't take and the charges that were not filed as much as you do the charges that were filed and the cases that you did take. And I'm interested in how that reflects your time in that office of what, because it really does put an imprint on that district of how you handle things.
Yeah, look, it's a very difficult thing, as I say in the book, to assess a decision not to do something, to assess a decision not to charge. It's hard enough to do that generally in life. You know, you can assess a decision to take a job because if the job is terrible, you say, well, that was a bad decision. It's much harder to evaluate not having taken a job because you don't know what those opportunities would have been like. You know, it's a counterfactual universe. And so it's hard to assess. And so you begin with that issue with respect to decisions not to charge. But then on top of that, as we've seen in the last year and a half through the prism of, you know, an FBI director and a special counsel, how difficult it is for people to assess a decision not to prosecute, whether it's Hillary Clinton or it's Donald Trump or it's anyone else, because we have a policy and a practice that's born of fairness of not disparaging people and shouldn't be disparaging people because they have no forum in which to defend themselves. If the decision is made at the end of the day because of the law and the facts, not to bring a criminal charge. But of course, that's a very, very important part of the exercise of discretion of any prosecutor. You know, first you have your investigation, you have your inquiry, you get out and you form no thesis in advance, no hypothesis in advance, and then you collect all your evidence. And there might be reasons why justice is served by not bringing a charge. You know, one reason, the most important reason, is there's not enough evidence to show a crime. And sometimes even when there is, there might be a reason not to do it because it's a piddling crime and there are other alternatives to prosecuting. You know, there are prosecutors' offices like the Manhattan DA's office that has decided in recent times that it's not going to charge people who are turnstile jumpers. There are movements in a lot of places not to charge people who are in possession of quantities of marijuana, especially small quantities of marijuana, even if there's proof that there's a technical violation of the law. And as I say in the book, and as I think is an important thing for people to remember, is that you judge a prosecutor's office for good or ill, not just by the cases it brings, but also by the cases it doesn't bring. And there are lots of debates that happen over time about broken windows and zero tolerance and those sorts of things. And I think it's an incredibly important part of moral reasoning and ethical reasoning, not just legal reasoning, to decide what are the ways in which you're going to deploy your resources. Are you really going to implement a zero tolerance policy at the border of Mexico and the United States that would require you, even in cases where people are simply seeking asylum, to separate mothers from their children? I think reasonable people would say no, even though there's a technical basis for bringing such a case. So, look, there are a lot of hard decisions to make in a prosecutor's office, as there are everywhere where people work and have to make decisions about things and have ethical considerations. But one of the most important and one of the hardest, which is clear from the spirit of your question, one of the hardest to explain to people in a satisfactory way is the decision to walk away, which is why I spend some time talking about it.
One of the things I found fascinating about that time you spent talking about it is that you say, look, you can't go beyond the law and you can't go beyond the facts. One of the examples that is given is about the times that you walked away from cases for those that helped precipitate the 2008 financial crisis. And you make the point, it doesn't mean that people didn't do terrible things, and it doesn't mean that people weren't reckless, negligent, or maybe even broke the law. So what then should our takeaway be? Because the other way of looking at that, of course, is somebody got away with something.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the circumstances. I spent some time talking about the financial crisis because it was an important event in the country, and a lot of people suffered. And you know who suffered? FBI agents and IRS agents and federal prosecutors too. And so everyone had an incentive, both professionally and personally, to hold anyone accountable that they could. But it doesn't mean necessarily that a crime can be proved. And in some instances, a crime probably wasn't committed. And I think people have this view that just because something bad happens, you know, a car crashes or a house burns down or, you know, a drug malfunctions or some other bad thing happens, that necessarily there's a law in the books with a low enough standard that allows you to pinpoint someone and prove them guilty in a court of law. And it may be very, very unsatisfying. But literally hundreds, if not thousands, of agents and prosecutors, not just in my office, but in Washington, D.C., in New Jersey, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, and on top of that, add hundreds and thousands of more in regulatory agencies, based on the existing law and facts as they could find them, couldn't recommend that a criminal charge be brought against the head of a financial institution in connection with the financial crisis. So what should we make of that? I think we make of that that it's hard to bring cases against folks. There's lots of people who, because they have plausible deniability, because you don't have recording devices in their offices, because people may not flip, right, or because we, rightly or wrongly, don't criminalize recklessness or negligence, that you can't bring those people to justice. So maybe, depending on the circumstances, laws should be changed or tools should be added, or people should understand that there are other ways to change cultures of places or other ways to punish and reform rather than through the blunt instrument of criminal prosecution.
The name of the book is Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. Preet Bharara is our guest. So let us just spend one moment before we move on exactly what you were talking about, because this is something else that you make this distinction in the book, that justice and the law are two very different things.
Yeah, so there's lots of things you can think are fair or just or not just. And there are lots of things that are written into the law that, depending on your perspective, you might think are not just. A lot of people think mandatory minimums are not just, and the way that they're applied suggest injustice. But the law may require them. So I think the law is always in a sort of a catch-up phase to try to catch up to what prevailing understandings and notions of justice are. Some people think that the use of a cooperating witness, I spent a lot of time, because it's interesting and also fraught, talking about the use of witnesses who flip, like Michael Cohen has seemed to, against President Trump, but in garden variety cases and mob cases and securities fraud cases also. What is the moral consideration when somebody like Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was a high-ranking member of the Gambino crime family, who confessed to killing 19 people, only gets 5 years in prison? Is that good? Because he was able to get lots and lots of other folks off the streets because he testified against them? Or is there some disproportionality there that caused an injustice? So, these considerations of what's moral, what's just, are related to what the law allows and requires, but not necessarily coextensive with it.
I want to ask you about, I want to go back to ideology for a moment, because you said—
I said there's no ideology.
There's no ideology. Right. So with that, there are many, many people on the left, even the right, who will say, but mostly the left at this point, that the one thing that the Trump administration has done is put its thumbprint squarely on the on the judiciary of this country, an effect that could be felt for decades. So with there being no ideology, how then is that not true? Or what should we, how should we look at that and the effect that the judiciary, that this administration will have in the judiciary in the years to come?
So when I say there's no ideology and should not be an ideology at the U.S. Attorney's offices or DA's offices, what I mean by that is that there should be no political ideology, meaning whether you're on the left or on the right doesn't matter in terms of who you hire or how you promote them or in the cases that you, you know, the targets that you, you know, subject to scrutiny. And I think that that's important for the rule of law. I think that's important for people's faith in the rule of law. That all of a sudden, if you have someone of a different political persuasion show up, that that doesn't mean that robbery cases are tried differently or public corruption cases are tried differently. Now, there can be differences in philosophy of prosecution. There can be differences in philosophy of leniency or toughness and differences of opinion as to how you go about bringing public safety and what resources should be applied to what and what the priorities are. And I think that's all fine and good. And you can have debates about that. That shouldn't necessarily fall down on the line of, you know, political ideology. And when you talk about judges, judges have to decide a lot of different things that are outside of criminal law. And many of those things, I think, are arguably subject to different points of view, depending on the political ideology you bring or the judicial philosophy you bring to the bench. You know, criminal prosecutors are not dealing with, you know, some of these hot-button social issues, generally speaking, like when does life begin, or what's the deal with assisted suicide, or, you know, how do you interpret a ban on people in the military, or how you deal with all sorts of, you know, immigration policy issues. You know, to some extent they are, but mostly they're not. And yeah, you know, any president puts his or her imprint on the judiciary to the extent that they're, you know, taking great care to find people who are in their mold. You know, there's a reason why, and it may be unfortunate, but it's a, you know, political fact that there is some predictability to the votes on the Supreme Court, depending on whether or not you were appointed by a Republican president or a Democratic president. There are exceptions to that, and there have been famously some people who have deviated from what the expectations are, but there is also some predictability, and that's the nature of politics. I think it gets, you know, skewed a little bit too far when people, I think, focus too much on ideology. Competence is important also, especially in the lower courts, and experience in courtrooms is important, especially with the lower courts. And so, you know, among the things to be concerned about is not just the ideology of people being appointed, but also something that's, you know, fairly unprecedented in recent times, and that is the number of people that this president has appointed or sought to put on the bench who have gotten, you know, unqualified reviews by the American Bar Association. So that's not a matter of ideology. That's a question of core competence. And I think that should worry people also.
So with all of that said, do you believe you were fired by the President of the United States because of his perception of your political ideology?
I have no idea why I was fired. You know, I had no entitlement to the job beyond, you know, the first day I was in it. President Obama could have fired me at any time. And President Trump, I presumed, would let all of us go in an orderly fashion, as is the custom. And so I, you know, I didn't have any entitlement right to the job. However, when he did, you know, very ostentatiously meet with me and ask me to stay on before even he had decided who the Secretary of State would be, I took that as a sign that, you know, he had good reasons for wanting me to stay on. I made it clear that we would be independent, but that he liked the work that we had done. There was this incident where he called me out of the blue, which seemed odd, on March 9th of 2017. And I didn't think it was appropriate to return the call because I think it would have undermined my independence. I didn't know the nature of the call. I didn't know how the call would be described later. And it wasn't set up through the Attorney General. There was no warning about the call. And given lots of things that were swirling around and requests that were being made about investigating the president and the memory of that tarmac incident that the president himself made a lot of hay out of with respect to Loretta Lynch meeting with President Clinton while right. the investigation of his wife, Hillary Clinton, was still ongoing, I chose that it was the better part of discretion not to have the call with the president. And 22 hours later, I and others were asked to resign. I don't know if those things are connected, so it may be that he viewed what I thought was a smart act of discretion that protected not only me, but more importantly, from his perspective, him. Maybe he thought that was insubordination, and that's what sparked the firing of everybody and having everyone leave essentially by the close of business, which, despite what people say, is unprecedented. But I don't have a clear idea, no.
So let us talk about the Mueller report for a moment. What do you think we will get out of a full redacted Mueller report?
It's kind of a contradiction in terms. A full redacted Mueller report.
Correct.
I don't know. It depends on how much is redacted. And that's the question on everyone's minds. But I think the most important thing that I'm looking for and that a lot of people are looking for is the degree to which there is evidence that the president obstructed justice. And clearly there's some evidence of that. You know, people get caught up in conflating various things. And you have people like Sarah Sanders saying, well, because there was a certain conclusion, there was no evidence of something. The special counsel found no evidence of X, Y, or Z. That's not how it works. There are occasions where there's no evidence. There's occasions where there's some evidence. There's occasions where there's lots of evidence, just up to the point of being able to bring a charge. And there's cases of overwhelming evidence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt when you decide to go forward with a case and probably will prevail at trial. And I'd like to see what the quantum of evidence is. Clearly, there's enough that caused the special counsel not to be comfortable saying that he could exonerate the president on the question of commission of a crime of obstruction. So I'd like to see the nature of it, the scope of it, the specificity of it, and the persuasiveness of it.
How long, if, is one question. Do you think we will see eventually the full report, number one? And two, if so, how long could that take?
I think eventually we'll see most of the report because there's enough of a public interest. There's enough of an interest on the part of people who are in a position to wield subpoenas and fight the battle in court to get the full thing out in public. But, you know, it could take a long time. It could take quite a long time, depending on how intransigent, you know, the president and his legal team want to be. So it could take months. It could take longer than that. I mean, we might not see the full thing until we're on the eve of or even after the next election, which is unfortunate.
Obviously, a lot is being made about your former office of the Southern District of New York and the U.S. attorney there and what role they will have in future cases coming from this report and things that have been sent to them. What do you make of the importance of the Southern District now and the work that they have ahead of them?
Well, I think they've always been an important office. They're in the spotlight now because they have overseen the Michael Cohen case. And the thing that, you know, strikes me in my mind, and I think a lot of people, is their endorsement of an allegation made by Michael Cohen, the president's former quote-unquote fixer and personal lawyer, where he said that he committed those campaign finance violations to which he pled guilty and for which he's going to prison, that he committed them in coordination with and at the direction of individual one, who's Donald Trump. So, you know, they had the fearlessness and the comfort in endorsing that allegation by putting it in a document that was filed by them in federal court. And there are some reports, I don't know, have any personal knowledge at all anymore about anything goes on in that office, and I should not. But there's reporting that they have interviewed other folks, and they have approached people like Hope Hicks and other people at AMI, which is the parent company of the National Enquirer. And I don't think they would have endorsed that allegation and adopted it if they didn't have considerable evidence beyond what just Michael Cohen is saying, because Michael Cohen himself has some baggage and has some credibility problems, and that they also, given their nature as, you know, fearless, aggressive, but fair prosecutors and investigators, if there are other things relating to the Trump Organization or the inaugural committee or anything else, they'll find all the facts. I think for the moment, I believe that they will still feel themselves constrained by the Department of Justice policy and practice of not prosecuting and indicting a sitting president. But I don't know that that holds for if and when the president leaves office.
Personal question, would you like to be there?
It's as I say in the dedication in the book, it's the finest place I will ever work with the finest people, because among other things, their mission was just to do good, you know, just to do the right thing in the right way and the right reasons. And they all cared about public service very deeply. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is, you know, people know my name to some extent because my name was on all the indictments and I, you know, announced charges at news conferences. And occasionally I would come and do shows like this and explain a little bit of our work and try to have some deterrent effect. But the work of that place was done by all sorts of people whose names you don't know and whose faces are not familiar to you. And they're really heroic and inspiring people. And whether it's in working around the clock to try to find and prosecute Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, which I talk about, or working around the clock to exonerate five people like an investigator, John O'Malley, did in my office along with the chief of violent crimes, Margaret Garnett, day after day after day, to try to get people who were falsely accused and falsely convicted out of prison when they had been charged by another DA's office. All of that work is incredibly inspiring. And at a time when, you know, the president and others denigrate government service and, you know, blithely immersed us in a shutdown for no good reason that I can think of, that it's good to celebrate good public servants who do their job every day because they believe in the right thing and they believe in, you know, making their country and their community a little better. And what better place to be in than a place like that? So, yes, of course, I miss it all the time.
I'm not going to ask you if you have any interest in running for office. I will ask you, do you think you would be a good politician?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I think I would be a good politician in some ways, and I think I would be not a good politician in other ways. The ways in which I would not be a good politician, which go to my reasons for not thinking elective office is my cup of tea, is I don't think I would be good at, you know, sitting at a desk and calling people up, person after person after person, and asking them for money. I don't think I'd be good at that. I also wouldn't be good at, you know, compromising myself. And I think sometimes you have to do that because there's a political calculation. I like to be myself. I like to be candid. And to the extent that sometimes can hurt you politically, that might make me a bad politician as well.
Preet Bharara is the host of the podcast Stay Tuned with Preet. He is also the author of the brand new New York Times bestseller Doing Justice, A Prosecutor's Thoughts on Crime, Punishment, and the Rule of Law. The book is published by Knopf. Preet Bharara, a great pleasure to have you back on our airwaves.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Again, the name of the book is Doing Justice, published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.